It's the Burt Cohen Show. Is part of a dream, isn't it? Hope is what President Obama ran on in his first term, and it disappointed a lot of people. He certainly became, or maybe he has always been, a centrist. Certainly his first term was not what most people would call a liberal, although the other side, who knows what they want to call it. But now it's in his second term, and there's some high hopes for some real effective action on a few issues. One, of course, is gun control. Another is foreign policy. And a big one is climate change. He even mentioned it in his inaugural speech. He mentioned a lot of things. Now we'll see if he is to follow through. And as the president has recognized, it's got to be pressure from the outside that drives this administration. It's always been the case. People out in the streets, people making noise. Hey, it's a democracy. It's a republic. That's the way it's supposed to work. And to make sure the president follows through on climate, there's going to be a rally February 17th down in Washington, of course, called the Forward on Climate Rally. And again, that's February 17th. And one of the organizers is a group called 350.org. And we have the media campaigner here with us today on the Burt Cohen Show, Dan Kessler. Dan, thanks for being with us. First of all, again, what is the 350.org? What's that number come from?
It's kind of wonky, but it refers to the safe amount of carbon in the atmosphere. So James Hansen, perhaps the country's most prominent climatologist, said that the safest number for us to be at is 350 parts per million of carbon. Right now, we're at about 397 parts per million. And before the Industrial Revolution, we were about 285 parts per million. So we've added about 115 parts per million over the last 120-some-odd years. And we've seen what that's done. It's raised global temperatures about 1 degree Celsius. It's led to what we experienced last year with, you know, Hurricane Sandy taking over, flooding New York City, half the country being in drought. And, of course, 2012 was the hottest year on record in the U.S.
Yeah, and rather stormy as well, no doubt about that. I don't know if we can directly connect all these intense storms with climate change, but it kind of seems like that to me, who is certainly not a meteorologist or a scientist of any sort. But what? Tell us about this Forward on Climate Rally. I had just heard about this. How did it come together? Who's involved? And what is the purpose of it, Dan?
Well, it's primarily organized by 350.org and Sierra Club, but we have over 100 partners now. And the purpose of it is to give the president exactly what he's been asking for since the day he took office, which was a movement that pushed him to take action. So as I was saying a few minutes ago, we're already experiencing climate change. We need immediate action. And the president needs to know that there's a constituency out there that's going to work with him, but also pressure him and push him to act on climate change. And the first things he can do or to say no to the Keystone XL pipeline, which is a really dangerous oil pipeline that's proposed to come down from Canada to the Gulf Coast. And another thing he can do is implement really strong carbon rules through the EPA to close down and limit the pollution from the country's largest source of greenhouse gases, which is coal plants.
And there has to be pressure, certainly, from the outside. He has to work with Capitol Hill. What's the any sense of where the 435 members of the House are and the 100 members of the Senate on things like the Keystone XL pipeline project?
Uh-huh. Well, that's just the thing. You know, there's a lot of things the president can do with executive orders and under his own power unilaterally. He doesn't need Congress. You know, there's a reason why Congress has a 13% approval rating. They're not doing very much right now. But the president can do a lot. He can say no to the pipeline by himself because it goes across a border. It's up to the president to say yes or no to the permit. And through the EPA, you can take a tremendous action as well, like increasing energy efficiency standards for our appliances, just like you did last year with cars and trucks,
mm-hmm.
and also the carbon rules that I was talking about earlier that would affect coal plants.
Now, it's got to be a lot of pressure on the president with regard to the Keystone Pipeline. And just to make sure people know what we're talking about here, this is something that starts up in, I believe it's Alberta, Canada. It's a huge, unbelievably huge project. And just to get to it requires great destruction of forests and bringing in monstrous trucks and ripping apart mountains. That's just to get to the tar sands. And then there's the distillation process and the shipping. So am I correct that it starts up in Alberta and then goes through which states is it looking at to go through now?
It goes through six states and ends up down on the Gulf Coast. So people can kind of get an understanding of the scale of this. In order to get this oil out from Canada, they have to actually boil the earth. They scoop it up, they boil it, and remove the oil from the mud. And every 3 days, they move enough earth to fill Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
And the size of the project, when it's complete, will be bigger than France. So it is absolutely humongous. It's been labeled by many climate scientists as the most destructive project on the planet. And there's huge opposition to it. And you were mentioning earlier that there's pressure on the president to say no to the pipeline. That's true. But that, you know, the pressure on him doesn't equal the pressure on the people who are dealing with climate change, whether they, you know, if they live in low-lying areas and they're threatened by sea level rise, or if they're a farmer in Nebraska who's dealing with drought. Those people are under a lot of pressure. The president just has to deal with the politics of it. And I have some sympathy for him, but he needs to do what's right and say no to this pipeline.
And what has he said about the pipeline so far?
Well, you know, this is the kind of the second go-around for this. Last year before the election, he denied a permit for the pipeline, citing threats to fresh water resources in Nebraska. There's an aquifer there that provides much of the water for farmers and ranchers, and the pipeline goes right through it. So the president said no to the permit, but since then, the company behind the pipeline, they're called TransCanada, have reapplied for the permit. So we have to go through this dance again and pressure the president to say no.
And, well, so far he did put a sort of a temporary hold on it last year, I believe, and he said something about looking at the science of the Keystone XL pipeline. Could that be a dodge for him, or what do you make of that? And what does his word mean, looking at the science of the Keystone XL pipeline?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that means different things to different people. To us, looking at the science means looking at the climate impacts of the pipeline, and those are inarguable that they'd be catastrophic. So, you know, he has a lot of smart people in his administration. He has Nobel laureates. He's got some of the most respected scientists in the world who I'm sure have told him what the consequences of not dealing with climate change are going to be. And the president knows this. You know, during the inauguration, he said a lot of courageous things about global warming and the need for action, how this is a moral issue. And the pipeline is a chance for him to prove, or I should say, move from words to deeds. So we expect him to say no to the permit.
What's any sense of the timeline on this? And is the demonstration on February 17th time to coincide with the timeline? Or is it possible he could make a decision before the 17th?
No, it's not possible because the State Department needs to release their environmental impact statement for it. So I would say somewhere around June would be the earliest that we'd get a decision. We timed this for February because it falls the day before President's Day, and this is really a challenge for the president on his leadership.
And again, pressure from the outside is what the president needs. And I can't remember the exact quote from A. Philip Randolph, who, when he was meeting with President Roosevelt, he was the head of the Pullman car workers, calling for an end to discrimination based on race. The president at the time said, "I'm with you. I agree with you. Now go out there and make me do it." It's been a tradition ever since then. So there are a lot of groups participating. Was it difficult to come to a decision to do this? And how, you know, I have to say that I think in Europe, people get out in the streets more often, more readily. People can see that it makes a lot of sense and it does really bring about actual political change. But that tradition seems to have faded a bit here. I'm not quite sure why. People seem to be kind of dispirited about getting out there on the streets. So tell us about how you as an organizer dealt with this kind of thing, you know, getting people out. If there's not large numbers there, then what?
Well, you know, I mean, to be fair, there are a lot of people who are out in the streets all the time in the U.S. And as you were saying earlier, we do have a great tradition of that, just like our friends in Europe do. You know, for the Iraq War, there were millions of people in the street. Unfortunately, it didn't change the policy.
Right.
On climate change, there's been, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the street as well. Last year, we surrounded the White House with 15,000 people. And 3 days later, the president said no to the permit for the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline.
Uh-huh.
So now we're hoping to double those numbers and get more people out on February 17th.
And tell us about this rally. That's a weekend, I assume. And maybe you can tell us where the route is and what the agenda is.
You bet. We will be meeting on the National Mall, and we will have tens of thousands of people there. I just found out we have over 100 buses coming from 28 states.
Wow. It's
pretty impressive.
Sure.
And there'll be a short rally at the beginning with some speakers. Bill McKibben will be speaking. Uh-huh. Mike Broom, the executive director of the Sierra Club.
And who is Bill McKibben?
Pardon me?
Who is Bill McKibben, for those who may not know?
Oh, Bill McKibben is the founder of 350.org,
uh-huh.
One of the people who's been spearheading this effort against the pipeline. The executive director of the Sierra Club will be there. There'll be some celebrities. There'll be a couple elected officials and senators who will be speaking. And then we'll do a march through Washington, including stopping and making a big human pipeline down 15th Street, which should be a great photo opportunity. And then come back and hear some music and then call it a day. But it's going to be a great day for organizing and for bringing people together and making sure the president hears us.
And which members of Congress? You said some senators are going to be there?
Yeah, I can't quite announce that yet, but there'll certainly be some elected officials there.
Oh, good. Well, and who is on the other side on this? What are the biggest challenges? I mean, there's pressure from both sides. Is it just, you know, people who care about the environment and the other side is the oil interests, or does it break down more than that? I mean, I assume there's a heck of a lot of pressure from the other side. Who the heck is the other side?
Well, no, it sounds sanctimonious to say this, but there's really the only two sides are people who care about protecting the planet for future generations, and then the oil companies who seem to have a business model that's dependent on destroying the planet. And that sounds, you know, I know that sounds to some people like that's a little bit crazy, but it's actually true. If you look at the business models of the companies like ExxonMobil and Shell that would benefit off projects like this, they're looking at raising the global temperature on this planet 6 degrees Celsius. We're talking 10 degrees Fahrenheit temperature rise by the middle of the century.
Whoa.
And I don't know about you, but that's really scary.
Yes.
And I like to think of environmentalists and people who care about this as actually conservatives. You know, we want to conserve the planet that we grew up on and be able to give that to our children. These guys seem to be intent on changing the physics and chemistry of our planet, which is pretty scary. So, you know, who's on the other side? It's the usual suspects.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of Republicans, unfortunately, who have been kind of bankrolled by the big oil companies. It's the American Petroleum Institute. It's ExxonMobil.
Mm-hmm.
Companies like that.
And as we said early on, the president said he's going to look at the science on the Keystone XL pipeline. What science could he be looking at? Is it the science of providing enough energy for America for the next 50 years or so that supporters suggest that this could do? Or is it the science of, you know, actual devastation from the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline? Any indication on that? And who are the people around him? Do you have any sense of what the president's going to do and which science he's going to look at?
I'm sure he'll be looking at what the State Department recommends to him. And, you know, the State Department, last year when they did their environmental impact statement, and again, forgive me, this is a bit technical.
Sure.
But essentially what they said was that this oil up in Canada is going to be developed no matter what. So we might as well build this pipeline and we might as well benefit off it. Well, a couple things about that. One, the oil industry themselves say that this pipeline is needed to develop the tar sands. And if they don't have it, they're going to have a surplus of oil that they can't get out. They can't actually ship it to market.
Mm-hmm.
They say this. The environmentalists don't say that. So there's really three ways to get the oil out, either through the east, the west, or the south. The east and the west have significant public opposition, and nothing is going to be built east or west anytime soon. right. that leads to the south, which is this pipeline. And that's why it's so important for us to defeat it.
Yeah, interesting. I'd heard it in Canada, in British Columbia, they didn't want any part of it. So that would be the western route to the ocean. And east, I'm not sure what Canadian province is to the east of it, but sounds like you're suggesting that they don't want it either?
Correct. I mean, it's not really a big surprise that people don't want a pipeline going through their backyards. That, you know, they're seizing the land of many people through eminent domain.
Oof.
There's these pipelines spill all the time. And, of course, people are really now drawing the connections, connecting the dots between extreme weather and climate change. And so they see what infrastructure projects like this can lead to, and that's why people want to get serious about moving towards solutions to deal with global warming and getting off of fossil fuels.
And you said that there are leaks all the time. I don't know about that. I mean, I can imagine people thinking, well, it's a pipeline. It's got to go through all kinds of environmental hoops and regulations. What kind of leaks would be the problem? And if it didn't leak, well, I guess there would still be a problem with burning this stuff and boiling the earth, as you say. But tell us about how often there are leaks on this. Isn't there a big oil pipeline in Alaska?
Yeah, I mean, there's oil pipelines all over the place, and they leak all the time. There's one that's very similar that goes through Kalamazoo, Michigan, by a company called Enbridge. And about a year and a half ago, it broke and spewed about 1 million barrels of oil into Kalamazoo, and they're still cleaning it up. So, you know, there's the oil spills, there's obviously the global warming emissions, and of course, they're now looking at the cancer rates that are associated with the tar sands and the development.
Huh.
You know, when they do this horrible refining up there and actually split the earth from the oil, it releases a lot of toxic compounds, and they use a lot of toxic compounds to get the oil, to get the oil out of the ground. And there's some new studies that are coming out showing that cancer rates are just absolutely spiking up in Canada where they're doing this development. So all the way around, from public health to environmental issues to spills to fresh water access, projects like this are really dangerous.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to The Burt Cohen Show. Our guest today is Dan Kessler, media campaigner with 350.org, and we are talking about the big rally, perhaps, coming up February 17th, Forward on Climate. So what, you know, if is there, it's often cast as a struggle between jobs, energy on one side, and the environment on the other. And environmentalists, not so much anymore, but used to be cast as, well, anti-energy, just Luddites want to, you know, not go forward. Are there realistic options and not just pie-in-the-sky options that we can get by without having new sources of oil? I mean, that brilliant star Sarah Palin said, drill, baby, drill. Do we have realistic options that can provide energy in the near future if we don't have this dirty oil coming from Alberta?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. I think the American people are starting to catch on to this idea that we actually have the technology right now to get off of fossil fuels. It's the question of political will. A couple anecdotes for you. Iowa, you know, you don't really think of Iowa as being the most progressive place in the world. They get about a quarter of their energy right now through wind power. It's zero emissions, zero global warming pollution, zero coal.
Wow.
Last year, Germany, again, not the sunniest place in the world, they had one day last year where the 50% of their electricity came from solar power. I guess the statistic that's been kind of blowing my mind lately is in the last 3 months of 2012, all new electricity generated in America, that's every new gigawatt of electricity in this country, came from renewable energy. There wasn't one new coal plant, not one new natural gas plant. It all came from wind, solar, and hydro. And so, again, we have the technology right now. What we don't have is politicians who are willing to go up against big oil and big coal and big gas and tell them no.
Well, the oil industry has been, as we know, heavily subsidized by me and you and all the taxpayers. But people see it as, well, it's free market. The oil companies are, you know, a capitalist, whereas if we have a government-run energy program, oh, that's socialism. How do you think that argument is working with the broad American public?
Oh, I think people are catching on to this stuff. I mean, the oil and gas industry has been subsidized for 150 years. And, you know, the president's making a big point of this actually right now, that we need to roll back the subsidies for the oil companies. who, by the way, are the richest companies in the history of money. They've made more money than since we invented money. Last year, ExxonMobil made $45 billion profit. Let's say that again, $45 billion profit.
That's net?
So these aren't really companies that need our sympathy. What they do need is pressure from us to get them out of our political system, off our backs, out of our communities.
And working Washington, who are some of the baddest of the bad guys in the Senate and the House?
In terms of politicians?
Yeah.
I'm not going to call anybody a bad guy, but when you look at the money that flows into Washington, D.C., it's pretty clear how our policy is written. You know, for instance, during the 2012 presidential election, the oil and gas lobby put $200 million into the election.
God. And as Bob Dylan said, money doesn't talk, it swears. So is this a partisan issue? Is it being seen in Washington as something that, you know, the Democrats are on one side, the Republicans are on another? Or is it breaking down those traditional partisan lines?
Well, I mean, some of it breaks down through partisan lines. Some of it breaks down by region, right? I mean, Midwest states and states in the Southeast are very dependent on coal power and fossil fuels. Of course, the Gulf Coast is dependent on oil production. There's political stuff that goes on, and of course, there's also regional differences.
And there's nuclear as well, and some people seem to argue that nuclear, well, it doesn't pollute. It must be green energy. Is the Forward on Climate rally going to avoid the issue of nuclear, or is it going to take it on as well?
No, it's not something we're really, really addressing. I mean, that's an interesting conversation to have. The thing with nuclear is that it's probably prohibitively expensive. A nuclear plant can cost upwards between $10 and $12 billion to build, and a lot of the money comes from federal guarantees. So again, a lot of our politicians who are against kind of what they say socialism and government-sponsored boondoggles, when it comes to the nuclear industry, they're wholly dependent on loan guarantees that come from the government.
Oh, completely. I mean, that whole Price-Anderson Act, they couldn't exist if they had to go out and buy insurance on the other. I'm curious, you know, sometimes there are traditionally divisions within ranks of old liberals and progressives. And, you know, most people who consider themselves environmentalists recognize that nuclear is completely unacceptable. But the focus, I guess, on this is, and so it involves 350.org, your organization, Sierra Club. Are there other environmental groups that are participating in it? And have there been the old traditional disagreements as to what issues should be focused on? Or is this one really just focused pretty much exclusively on Keystone XL tar sand pipeline?
You know, it's really focused on climate change and making sure that the president knows that we're serious about him taking action. But there are a few things that we're asking him to do, and one of them is say no to Keystone XL pipeline.
So it's climate change in general. What about the idea of a carbon tax that, since it obviously contributes badly to climate change, what about the idea of a carbon tax? Are there people within your coalition of groups that are pushing for a carbon tax? Will that be something that's talked about at the rally on the 17th?
You bet. I mean, every environmental group is behind a carbon tax, and it's perhaps the most important public policy question we have out there right now. You know, the fossil fuel industry stands alone as one of the only industries that's allowed to dump their garbage for free. And a carbon tax would fix that problem. They need to pay for their garbage. And right now their garbage is, of course, carbon dioxide emissions.
Yeah, and it's huge, huge amounts that are just generated every day. And I don't have the numbers, obviously, but the more people know about it, the more they want to take action on it. Part of the problem in creating pressure is the media. There have been large demonstrations in the past that the mainstream media has basically ignored. And if the media doesn't cover something, it's like it doesn't exist. What's your sense of if there's some big, news issue that day, obviously it doesn't get as much attention. But what's your sense of how the mainstream media is expected to cover this thing?
Well, I expect we'll get a lot of media coverage. The pipeline has received a lot of media attention because it's become so political. And you know, I'm not one of those people who really blames the media for not covering climate change. I blame ourselves more for not making this visually interesting, compelling stories that go with it, and, you know, kind of feeding the media beast. They are, in many ways, just a proxy for the American people, and it's our job to be giving them great stories to tell, and they're under a lot of pressure as well. I know they're kind of a convenient entity to be beating up on, or institution to beat up on. I like doing it too sometimes, but you know, there's a growing movement in this country around climate change and getting off of fossil fuels, and I anticipate the media increasingly will be paying attention to that.
And of course, so much politics is theater, and you have to grab the attention. And it sounds like the human pipeline. That sounds like a good little angle there. Perhaps if you can just run that by us again, what this human pipeline is going to be.
Right. Yeah, I mean, my job is to give the media these interesting stories and images. So one of them is, we'll be making this human pipeline down 15th Street. We'll see how many people we have. You know, it could be 20 or 30,000 people making this, so it should make a very, very cool image.
Yeah, indeed, images. Every picture tells a story. You gotta have an image that people can get really quickly, unfortunately. I mean, details are important, but I do agree, Dan, that more and more people are waking up that, hey, something is going on here. We can't absolutely prove that the raging wildfires, the crippling droughts, and the big storms are definitely part of climate change, but I think people are starting to get it. If people want to find out more about this and how to get there and how to be a participant, I'm sure there's some website to which you can point them.
You should go to forwardonclimate.com. Forward on Climate. They can register for buses. They can find out about the route. They can communicate with their neighbors. Forwardonclimate.com.
Forwardonclimate.com. Dan Kessler, 350.org. Hey, I wish you very good luck. It sounds like a really important thing to be getting on there, and people need to get up and stand up. Thanks for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. Dan Kessler at 350.org.
Thanks for the opportunity. Take care.
All right.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a cord that Peter is cold. Sky. Take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours unhurt. And now you see the light, you stand up for your rights. Yeah.
Get up, stand up.
Jump, jump.
Stand up for your rights.
Don't give up the fight. It's too important to give up, for sure. Burt Cohen here. We're switching gears now, going to talk about that white paper that came out, The President's Right to Kill Americans. No, I'm not making this stuff up, and no, I'm not talking about George W. Bush. not talking about Nixon either. We're talking about this allegedly liberal president, Barack Obama. There's been a disclosure very recently of a 16-page document with a detailed legal analysis of the targeted killing of Americans. And the barricades of secrecy surrounding the drone killings by the Obama administration have been breached. Finally, the administration has fought fiercely against releasing any unclassified documents. And if this gets your blood boiling, good. That's the idea. Our guest right now on the Burt Cohen Show is Center for Constitutional Rights Senior Attorney Pardis Kebriyai. Thank you, Pardis, for being with us. Tell us about this white paper and the president's reaction to it, if you would, please.
Sure. Well, the white paper, I think, number one, there's been a lot of talk about it, but it's important to be clear about what it does not say or explain. What it doesn't explain is the majority of the 4,000 or more deaths that have occurred as a result of the targeted killing program. What it does talk about is the administration's rationale for the killing of a U.S. citizen in very specific circumstances. It says that where the U.S. believes that someone is a senior leader of a terrorist organization that it deems is part of its global armed conflict with al-Qaeda, and that person presents an imminent threat, that the use of lethal force against that person without charge or trial is allowed. And there are problems with the white paper, but again, it's important to be clear that those circumstances don't describe most of what's happening in the world right now by the U.S. as far as the targeted killing program. For example, we represent at CCR an individual, the family member of a 16-year-old U.S. citizen boy who was killed in Yemen in 2011. This white paper certainly does not explain his killing. He was someone who the U.S. had never said two words about. So that point is important. But as far as, you know, what the memo does say, it makes clear, as we've known, that the administration thinks that it can use drones and armed force, warlike force in countries against suspects, wherever those people may be, even if it's in countries that the U.S. is not at war with, and that it's making these decisions entirely without meaningful oversight. It's making these decisions based on the determinations of a group of national security officials whose evidence and whose legal rationales are never looked at by a court. They're barely looked at by Congress, and it's making these decisions entirely unilaterally. And when we look at this and compare what the Bush administration was doing when it came to detention and all of the concern about detentions, for example, at Guantanamo, which for years were, hundreds of people were held without court review because, Donald Rumsfeld and others said those people were dangerous terrorists. And we found out later, after those people were able to start challenging their detentions, that in fact many were wrongfully held. It's hard to see the real difference between what was happening then and what's happening now, except that now we're talking about killing and not just detention.
Well, that 16-year-old that you mentioned earlier, Pardis, was that a collateral damage or was that an intentional killing of the 16-year-old?
Well, it's unclear because the administration hasn't said anything about it. The person is, his name is Abdul Rahman al-Awaki. He's actually the son of Anwar al-Awaki, 16-year-old boy, American citizen born in Denver, Colorado, who was killed by a U.S. drone strike in October of 2011 as he was sitting outside eating dinner with his teenage cousin. And, in the initial reports that came out after that strike, he was described as a 20-something-year-old militant by anonymous government officials. It was only after his family released his birth certificate showing that he had in fact been born in 1995 that the government corrected itself. But beyond that, that erroneous statement that they initially made, they have not said anything about who they were after in that strike, whether Abdul Rahman was a target, whether he was a bystander, what the circumstances were, and why he's dead. They haven't acknowledged that strike at all, and I think that actually goes to a broader point. Despite what we know, the plain evidence of these strikes and people dead, the administration's official position in court, anyway, is that it continues to say that it can't confirm or deny the existence, the very fact of these strikes, which is just a confusing position. But it continues to deny that it's even doing these things, let alone, you know, offering any kind of explanation for them.
It's been interesting talking to people as I've been preparing for this show about this, and people don't want to believe it. They say, Obama? You know, Obama's the relatively liberal guy. You know, George Bush claimed he had, tremendous executive power, but he never claimed he could order the assassination of an American citizen without judicial review. I mean, Article 5 of the Bill of Rights says, nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Are they saying that they can't do due process here and that it's just too inconvenient to do that? How are they getting around? I mean, he was sworn in to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. This is something that just seems incredible, that an executive could order killings of not just, you know, internationals, that would be bad enough, but American citizens. What's their justification for doing this without due process?
Well, the justification is the same one, actually, that the Bush administration asserted, which is why, you know, it really is fair to say that what the Obama administration is doing is really a continuation of the rationale of the Bush administration, except that in killing, it's been expanded under his watch. But the basic rationale is that since 9/11, the United States has been engaged in a war with al-Qaeda, and with not just al-Qaeda, but associated forces of al-Qaeda, and that war, that armed conflict, which is the legal term, extends potentially anywhere. It's not limited to the battlefields of Afghanistan. It wasn't limited to the battlefields of Iraq. It justifies killing people under the laws of war, which are broader. They allow for things like detention and killing in broader circumstances than the Constitution normally requires. But the administration, on the basis of this ongoing global war, can use war force, military armed force against suspected terrorists wherever they may be. So that's one rationale. The other rationale is sort of a legal, a right to national self-defense rationale.
Hmm.
Without getting too technical about it, one point that's important to be clear there is that under the law, self-defense only addresses whether using, whether firing a missile in the territory of another country is okay to do. It only has to do with the question of sovereignty. So saying that these killings are justified as a matter of self-defense is something that might explain how the U.S. can use these drone strikes in the territory of Pakistan. But it doesn't have anything to do with whether the killing of a specific person is illegal or not. And so it's the U.S. is actually using that rationale in the wrong way. It's misapplying that rationale. But those are the twin kind of, positions of the U.S. is that it can do these things as a matter of self-defense and as a matter of this ongoing armed conflict.
Hmm. It's just so amazing in so many different ways. I can't imagine how it would not give aid and comfort to the enemy, really, and help recruit any kind of people who use terrorism against us. Just, I mean, strategically, it just seems positively insane. What is, just from a legal aspect of it, I mean, the idea of people with questionable authority ordering the killing based on just their feelings or something like that. It's just, it's amazing. It boggles the mind. So what is the Center for Constitutional Rights doing about this right now?
Well, in 2010, before there was as much attention as there is now, and we're really heartened to see how much more attention there is now, but back in 2010, when the U.S. first reported, or the media reported, that the U.S. had authorized in advance the killing of a U.S. citizen in Yemen, Anwar al-Awlaki, we brought a case on behalf of al-Awlaki's father challenging the legal standards that we believe the U.S. was asserting to be able to do something like that. We said that Yemen is not a country that the U.S. is at war with. and you've got a U.S. citizen on the other side, then therefore the Constitution applies, and you can only kill if you've charged and tried that person. But there may very well be evidence of, you know, of wrongdoing against him. But if that's the case, the U.S. had to charge and try him, had to give him due process. That's basic under the Constitution. And that other than that, they could only kill him if he presented an imminent threat and lethal force is a last resort. These mm-hmm. aren't standards we made up. These are standards that come from the Constitution. And all we were trying to do was just to enforce the law and get the court to do the same thing. What ended up happening with that case is that it was dismissed because the court ended up finding and agreeing with the government. We sued, we brought the case against President Obama, but the court ended up agreeing with the government that it wasn't the court's role to interfere in the decision to carry out a strike against al-Awlaki, which which is an alarming conclusion because, you know, we're talking about an allegation of the Fifth Amendment on behalf of a U.S. citizen, for a U.S. court to say it has no business enforcing that person's Fifth Amendment right is wrong to
sure.
us. What we've done since then is, as people probably know, the U.S. carried out that strike in September of 2011, and then 2 weeks later it carried out a second strike killing 16-year-old Abdul Rahman. And what we've done now is, on behalf of the families of Anwar al-Awlaki and Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, and then another U.S. citizen who was killed with al-Awlaki in September, we filed a case against the CIA and the military officials who we believe are responsible for those strikes. And that case is now pending in district court in Washington, D.C. The defendants in that case last month filed a motion to dismiss the case, making the same arguments that the government had made before, that, you know, this case concerns national security and military matters and that it's not the business of the courts. And we just responded in a motion filed earlier this week to basically say that, no, in fact, you know, when you've got alleged violations on behalf of U.S. citizens claiming violations of their most fundamental rights, the court has a role. It has to have a role. And, in fact, the Supreme Court has asserted its role, even when it's come to claims by non-citizens held at Guantanamo. So how can it be that claims on behalf of citizens can't be heard in this context? So that's what we're trying to do is through those cases, bring to bear some kind of judicial review of what the executive is doing and bring to bear some accountability.
I wonder if there are people who would argue that, look, we're in a state of war. These guys don't play by the rules. We are in a state of national security that we have to just lay aside the inconvenient constitution for now because we just have to do this. And if we went through the normal legal process, we couldn't fight the war against terrorism. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's important to be clear that the Constitution doesn't mean that the U.S. Can't protect itself and that it can't use lethal force to kill people, even, who present enough of a threat to use that kind of force. Pre-9/11, you know, there was still terrorism. And the U.S. was using a law enforcement, you know, framework for addressing threats of terrorism. Most of the countries in the world rely on their domestic laws, their own constitutions, and basic international human rights law to respond to terrorist threats on their own soil. And that's happened internationally with allies of the U.S. and in Europe, for example. Countries that have suffered serious terrorist attacks on their own soil post-9/11, they've resorted to their own laws to respond, and they've been able to respond.
Right.
So it's important to just be clear that, you know, those laws don't prevent the U.S. from protecting itself. And in fact, using the laws of war and declaring this global war is more dangerous in a sense because it gives license to other countries and countries that many people probably wouldn't want to have that kind of authority to do the same thing, to say, well, if the United States can say, you know, we can send drones into any country we want and target our citizens or the citizens of other people, of other countries in those places, well, why can't we do the same thing? And that kind of copycat effect and can only be, you know, a dangerous thing. I think it would just lead to complete chaos and a lot of violence, and it's just not a situation that I think anyone would want. So it's important, separate from the law, to just think about, is that the kind of world we want, and is this the kind of power we want other countries to have?
True. And just, I know you have to run, but let me just ask, members of Congress must be hearing from their constituents. They must be feeling the pressure on this. Do you have, what's your sense of any degree of optimism on this and changing this policy?
Well, I do have more optimism. I mean, I think the leak of this memo earlier this week has really, to us, there's not that much that's new here, but people are paying attention to it because
right.
there's now this memo that people can read, and it's not just an article in the newspaper. I think it's alarmed people, and certainly it's alarmed members of Congress, and they've demanded to see at least the legal memos that justify the killing of U.S. citizens. Just, you know, yesterday there's news that President Obama has decided to release those memos to members of Congress that discuss the killings of U.S. citizens in certain circumstances. That's positive. It's not enough. The public needs to know, not
yes.
just select members of Congress. But it's a step in the right direction, and I think there's definitely momentum building to hold the government accountable, to force it to say what it's doing. I mean, at this point, the minimum is to explain itself. And there's a way that it can do that actually will not harm national security, and it owes the American public at least that much when it's claiming the authority to be able to kill American citizens without charge or trial.
Well, as one of our founders said, we have a republic if we can keep it. A national security state is quite different from a republic, I would say. I don't think there's any exaggeration to say that there is that threat there of having something other than a republic. Well,
right.
I know you have to run. Thank you very much. If people are interested in following this, is there a website for the Center for Constitutional Rights that would be particularly good to point people to?
Sure. We have a case page for the case against the 16, you know, on behalf of the 16-year-old and the cases that I was talking about on our website. Our website is ccrjustice.org. You can look for the case there. We have the motions from the government and that we filed, and other information on our website, including some videos by our client that I think are pretty powerful for people to see.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for
Pardis
having me.
Kebriai, unfortunately, has to run, but people can put pressure on their members of Congress right now to tell them how they feel about this extrajudicial, executively ordered killing. Killing for peace, it doesn't work. And subverting the Constitution of the United States, hello, we're not, we cannot allow that. And here to sing about this is The Fugs.
Kill, 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 kill
The Fugs from the mid-60s. Going to play another song. This is called License to Kill. Is there a License to Kill? This would be Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers from a 30th anniversary concert celebration for Bob Dylan back in 1993.
Man thinks, because he rules the earth, he can do as he pleases, and if things don't change soon, he will. Man has invented his doom. The first step was touching the moon. Now there's a woman on my block. She just sits there as night grows still. And she says, who will take away his license to kill? Now they're taking and they're teaching and they're grooming for life. They set him on a path where he's bound to get ill. Then they bury him with stars. They sell his body like they do used cars. And there's a woman on my block. She just sits there facing the hill. She says, who's gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's hell-bent for destruction. He's afraid and confused. And his brain has been mismanaged with great skill. Yeah, all he believes are his eyes. And his eyes, they just tell him lies. But there's a woman on my block. And she just sits there in a cold chill. She says, gonna take away his license to kill. It may be a noisemaker, spirit maker, heartbreaker, fat breaker, leave no stone unturned. You may be an actor in a plot, maybe all that you've got, till your error is clearly learned. He worships at an altar by a stagnant pool. And when he sees his reflection, he's fulfilled. Yeah, man is opposed to fair play. He wants it all, he wants it his way. But there's a woman on my block. She just sits there as night grows still. She says, who's gonna take away his license to kill?
sunrise doesn't last all morning. A cloudburst doesn't last all day. Seems my love is up and has left you with no warning. It's not always gonna be this great. All things must pass. All things must pass away. Sunset doesn't last all evening. A mind can blow those clouds away. After all this, my love is up and must be leaving. It's not always gonna be this great. All things must pass. All things must pass away. All things must pass. Not like streams. Face another day, not a darkness only stays at night time. In the morning it will fade away. Daylight is good at arriving at the right time. It's not always gonna be this great. All things must pass. All things must pass away. All things must pass. Not a life's dream. Darkness only stays at night time. In the morning it will fade away. Daylight is good at arriving at the right time. It's not always.